Welcome back to our series, The Media and Politics. Are they an unholy alliance, or are they just working for the same goals, scratching each other's backs? What exactly is going on? We thought we would talk to Mike Miller. He has a big background in both the media and politics. Mike was a TV anchor and even worked as a Washington reporter for a Washington television station in D.C. Plus, he worked for three Republican office holders, two congressmen and one senator. They were all very conservative. Mike Miller, however, might surprise you with his views. First, we're going to talk about James Inhofe, the senator from Oklahoma, who made the statement one time, the way to get reelected in Oklahoma is to run on guns, butter, and God.
Senator Inhofe, you have called the threat of catastrophic global warming, quote, the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people, and that man-induced global warming is an article of religious faith.
I actually believe that man-made gases caused global warming back when I was first the chairman of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, until we found out what it would cost us if we conformed with Kyoto. We were getting ready to sign Kyoto at that time, and it was between $300 and $330 billion a year. And so we thought, let's at least look at the science and see that it's there. And I can tell you right now that the scientists that were very strongly for it at first are not now. And you haven't heard much about it recently. We're not now. You know, God's still up there. We're now going through a cooling spell. And the whole issue there was, is it man-made gases, anthropogenic gases, CO2, methane? I don't think so.
We're talking with Mike Miller on the line from Florida. Mike, Jim Inhofe is a very, he says he's a religious guy. And at one time he basically said, you know, whatever God's will is what will be done. And of course that appeals to a lot of people. He's pretty conservative, but you've worked for a lot of conservatives.
Yeah. Well, I found Inhofe to be very, very, the most conservative member I'd worked for. Ed Bethune was a pragmatic conservative, kind of like, I think, the way I am. Chick Heck was a hard-working Jesse Helms clone.
Well, a lot of people probably don't remember him, but I spent some time in Nevada. He was pretty right-wing.
Most conservative member of Congress. He used to refer to Jesse Helms as his liberal friend.
Jesse Helms.
Yeah. And but to me, Inhofe appeared to be more of a middle-of-the-road fascist. Anyway, this guy said he's not a deep thinker and you can help him, and he recommended me to him, and I got the job as his...
Mike, you're not the first person said that about Senator Inhofe, that he's not a deep thinker. You're being kind. But he seems to be successful. He's been there for some time.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know how he gets along. I know that some of his fellow House members at the time, I don't know how well they get along, because he walked into the office one day and he said, I just rode up the elevator with Barney Frank and I told him, you know, I've never met a real queer before. And, you know, Inhofe didn't reveal that Barney took a swing at him, but he added, I sure hope I didn't catch AIDS riding in that elevator with him.
And Inhofe was serious?
Oh, yeah. AIDS was first reported back in 1981, 10 years earlier. By 1991, most people were well aware that AIDS wasn't spread by casual contact, you know, riding in an elevator. Anyway, that's my account of Barney Frank's comments, and then they were made in front of the entire staff, were included in a lengthy profile on Inhofe in February 2008 in an issue of the Oklahoma Gazette. Now, that's a publication you may not be familiar with, because I think it's only available around Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Have you? Okay.
I used to live in Oklahoma City. I used to be on the radio.
The profile on him, something about a mountain. You know, the M in James M. Inhofe, do you know what the M stands for?
No.
Mountain. I'd say it should be molehill, but anyway. They quoted me, what I just said to you about the Barney Frank thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then this was right in the heat of his campaign, and his campaign spokesman issued a response to my quote that was also published in this same article, and it said, well, it's been nearly 20 years since his short stint with the senator's office. He meant congressman, I guess. Mr. Miller's comments seem to be nothing more than the unfiltered remarks of a disgruntled former employee. And Inhofe said in a recent interview that the AIDS subject wasn't something that he had done any research on at the time. He never denied any of it. And then another example of his mental capacity or incapacity was it stands out in my memory. One day the House was voting on an appropriations bill that contained a project that was eagerly sought by the Tulsa Office of the Army Corps of Engineers, and his legislative staff told him in very clear language, Jim, you need to vote for this. You have to vote yes on this appropriations bill. Well, when he returned from the House floor, Inhofe was quizzed whether he voted in favor of the Tulsa project that was so important. And he said, I voted no. And why? Everyone asked at once. Inhofe just shrugged his shoulders, closed the door to his office, and we were all just stood around with our mouths open.
Yeah.
He tended to do very unexpected things. Even though, you know, you knew where he stood philosophically. It was very strange working for him. I got the feeling that, number one, he wouldn't take, advice. It was very difficult to work for him as press secretary. When I joined his staff, he was taken off for Kuwait on a fact-finding congressional junket following Operation Desert Storm. Remember that?
Yes.
And I suggested that he invite, while he's over there, invite Kuwaiti officials to conduct a how to do business with Kuwait seminar in Tulsa and, get some publicity over that. Inhofe didn't follow up on any of that. And I also advised him to position himself next to prominent celebrity newsmakers. At least he'd appear in some news footage, but he didn't even do that. I detailed in memos outlining an extensive media plan, all kinds of things for him, to raise his profile and improve his image, because he was getting some really bad editorials in the Tulsa papers at the time. And I said, to find an area of need, introduce some legislation. And since he liked to fly, I thought maybe, he ought to do something related to aeronautics. He could become an expert on aviation on Capitol Hill and use that position to promote the aerospace industry in Tulsa. He ignored that. He was absorbed. Flying was the only thing he was interested in that I could see. And
well, he seems to like his job. He keeps running for re-election and getting re-elected.
Yeah, I don't think he's ever held a real job and worked. He's always been elected office.
Well, he did have that insurance company there in Tulsa in the Philtower building. He and his family ended up suing his brother over it, and I think the thing went bankrupt finally.
But, when shortly after I arrived, and I was only there for 6 months, but he announced that he wanted to pilot a Cessna 414 around the world, retracing the 1931 flight of Oklahoma aviator Wiley Post.
Oh, Wiley Post, okay.
Remember that?
Yeah.
You probably don't remember the flight, original flight, but it was in a plane named the Winnie Mae. Well, I talked to Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum into allowing Inhofe to hold a news conference to announce his flight right in front of Post's original Winnie Mae. It was there in the museum. And I thought, you know, the event added some stature and authenticity to this, what was essentially a publicity stunt. The museum officials also allowed me to tell reporters that the trip was under the auspices of the Air and Space Museum. I remember this one Smithsonian official who earlier said no deal on co-sponsoring this gimmick. He asked me what auspices meant. I said, absolutely nothing. It just looks good in print. And right after, before he left on this Brown and World trip, here's another example, I think, of Enhoff and his mindset. Staff advised him to get a visa because he was planning to land in Moscow and that one would be required. Enhoff vetoed that idea, saying, hey, I'm a congressman, I won't need a visa. I'm, you know, important. I'm an important person. And then when he landed in Moscow without the visa, he was immediately placed under house arrest. And it took 3 days, I think, for the American embassy to get him free so he could resume his flight. Of course, the media was calling me every day for a report on how things were going on his round-the-world trip. And when Enhoff was arrested, I decided that I just would go home and not take any calls. I didn't want to lie to any reporters. You know, a good press secretary may not tell a reporter everything he knows, but he sure shouldn't lie. That can be disastrous.
Yeah, once you're caught.
Yep, caught in a lie, you can't. What was it, the senatorial committee? Lies would blow candidates right out of the water. They'd lie about their, oh, I was a war hero in Vietnam, you know, and the reporter would check and find out he'd never even served in the military. And that would be the end of that candidate. So you don't lie. But then anyway, he...
Well, Mike Miller, you've given me some information I didn't know about Senator Inhofe. He spent some time under Soviet arrest.
Well, it was hushed up. I mean, I hushed it up. I didn't hush it up. I just didn't...
Report it. Yeah.
But he went on vacation for a month when he got back, supplying in ammunition to those cynics who complain of Capitol Hill's all play and no work policy. And when he got back, I got a phone call from his administrative assistant in Tulsa, a guy named Bruce Thompson. He said, things just aren't working out, Mike. Jim wants you to clear out your desk and leave the office before he returns tomorrow. I was really dumbfounded. Usually a firing follows some warning. You know, you get an email or something, mm-hmm. You know, a memo. I hadn't received anything like that, and he'd gotten great press on his round-the-world trip. But I really suspected that he refused to follow any kind of strategy that might require additional effort, hold hearings or introduce legislation. Unlike the other members of Congress I worked for, Inhofe apparently felt that there was absolutely no need to continue his congressional duties once he'd returned home, you know, like on weekends. Most members would visit with constituents to seek their views, sometimes try to resolve problems. They hold town hall meetings, news conferences when they go back to their district. Lawmakers tour new federal projects or areas in need of help from the federal government. But from what I observed, Inhofe preferred to relax away from Washington. The key word there is relax.
I understand.
And when Congress recessed most weekends, Inhofe would usually head right for his Grand Lake retreat, seldom making it into the Tulsa office. And at the lake, if he worked on anything at all, it was probably his tan. I thought he was one of the laziest congressmen I've ever seen. I hate to say that, but it's...
You know, Mike, when we talk about James Inhofe, I keep marveling at how he always gets reelected. over and over and over?
I don't know. The thing about it is he's a conservative in a fairly conservative state.
Well, Oklahoma is the reddest of the red states, at least according to the last presidential election. And just like that Soviet jail incident, he probably could have used that to his advantage. Ruskies arrested me.
You know, there are a lot of people in Oklahoma that are part of that constituency that can identify with, you know, it's an evangelical streak he's got in him that my guess is that his opponents didn't have. So that got him a...
Well, you worked with him and for him. I mean, is that religion bona fide? I mean, is he religious?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Very much so.
Well, at least he's not a hypocrite.
No, he is religious. But he also religiously would, you know, relax up at Grand Lake instead of doing some work around the district. My guess is that these are things that most people... And most Oklahoma voters weren't aware of.
Well, what goes around comes around, or at least it did on Inhofe. I mean, he hangs out at that lake, and he got a bacteria up there, a pollution. And, you know, he's been fighting against pollution, not against having pollution, but trying to control pollution. And he's been sick, got real sick.
In his last campaign... some people tried to promote my book with the section I had on Inhofe, which is kind of the stuff we've been talking about. I had a chapter in the book called Earth to Congressman Inhofe, and I think they thought that by promoting the book, people would find out about the real Inhofe and vote against him if it got a wide enough circulation. Well, number one, it didn't get a wide enough circulation. And the big mistake I think they made is trying to promote it among liberals. It should have been promoted among conservatives. Liberals weren't going to vote for him anyway. Conservatives are the ones who needed to be enlightened about Inhofe. And I think that was a mistake we had made. He was always coming in the office talking about Tom DeLay, my friend Tom DeLay. He's my buddy, Tom DeLay. So, I don't know, maybe your friends influence you a little bit. I think DeLay was also had that religious streak in him.
They all seem to be members of the family, you know, that religious cult, or at least I think it's a cult. Lots of congressmen, lots of senators belong to it.
Their rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that part of it, I don't think they're hypocritical. But some of the mistakes he made were just stupid mistakes. They weren't really philosophical mistakes. I think he's a conservative. There's no question about it. But do you want a good conservative or a bad one? I just think he's a bad one. And, you know, he can say that this is sour grapes from a disgruntled employee, and, yeah, sure. But that doesn't change the fact that he's exactly the way I described
him. Mike, you know, this is part of a series we're doing on politics and the media. Why don't you explain to people, since you've been a press secretary at least three times, and then you were with the senatorial committee, the Republican senatorial committee, so you have plenty of experience on that side of the fence. Tell people what a press secretary does. We know he puts out fires.
Oh, yeah. Well, number one, I think the first thing they do, a press secretary, is that they're the spokesman for the office. And if a lot of times a member of Congress will want to issue a statement or a press release, and you are in charge of that, so you either read the statement or you tell an inquiring member of the news media the member's position on issues or whatever he's trying to get across that day. You have to be able to write press releases, and then you also you're responsible for generating media coverage, which includes not only press releases but photo ops, radio programs. The Hill has all kinds of media facilities to help press secretaries do their job in both parties. And each party has their own. But you can videotape reaction to something. For example, if you wanted to say something about the debt crisis, you could go to the TV studio and record something and tape a 30 or 40 second sound bite of your reaction, and then they would satellite it out to the TV stations in your state. And believe it or not, they would run these things about 90% of the time. And you do the same thing with radio stations, just easier to do. You could tape either sound bites or a radio program, and they would feed it out to all the radio stations in your district or state. And they would do all the work. You also do newsletters. Yeah, you'd have to write their newsletters. Sometimes you'd write their speeches. Ed Bethune didn't use, he never used a written speech. He just went from notes. But everybody else, I think, used a printed speech. So you'd have to be able to write speeches. That's the kind of thing you do.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the media. We've talked about politics and politicians. You're qualified to talk about the media. You were in it for a long time. A television anchor and a reporter, what, in Tulsa, Little Rock, Washington, D.C.? I think down in Dallas, Fort Worth, too, right?
Oh, yeah, I was in Dallas for a while. WFAA, it's a big station.
Yes, it is.
I had gone from Channel 8 in Tulsa to Channel 8 in Dallas, and it was kind of a shock. We had about 20 employees in Tulsa and about 90 in Dallas. Anyway, Marty Haig was the news director, and he hired me on the recommendation of a guy who had been our station manager without even seeing me. And he had just taken over, and he put in a new system where you had a beat. All the reporters had a beat. Mine was a police beat.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good in a way because you usually led the news with the latest murder or armed robbery.
Right,
bank robbery,
if it leads, it bleeds.
Right. And it sure did in Dallas.
And, it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah. And I did a five-part series on prostitution that I thought was really good. We borrowed a camera lens that could shoot in the dark, total darkness. You know, you get that green tint, but you could shoot prostitutes from a block away with a telescopic lens, and then we used wireless microphones, and some of the vice squads were very cooperative. Got into a van, an unmarked van. And then they had a plainclothes cop in a Cadillac convertible with the top down, and he would talk to these prostitutes, negotiate with them, and we'd film from the van and pick up his audio with the wireless mic. I remember at one point when we left the police station in this van, the first thing they do, I mean, these guys were kind of wild. First thing they do is go to a liquor store and buy a couple of cases of beer, and everybody started drinking in the van. And I remember my audio man at one point said, you know, I'm not picking the cop up in the convertible. And he said, my antenna, I'm not, you know, I need to get my antenna outside this van. And this cop said, oh, no problem. So he pulled out his gun and shot a hole in the roof. I mean, without batting an eye. Bang!
Now, it's been a long time since I've done police reporting, and it's been in small markets, but like Muskogee, my hometown. But it was pretty obvious to me right off the bat, the best way to get the story is become buddy-buddy with the cops, you know?
Afterwards, you know, when we were trying to do this story, the lawyers got involved, and they say you've got to have more white prostitutes. You're not, the girls on the street were mostly black, and then Dallas was having a lot of racial problems at the time, and they did not want to run a piece implying that all the prostitutes were black, because they weren't. But the problem was the white prostitutes were mostly call girls, and they were working the conventions
hotels.
In the hotels.
Yeah.
But I explained all this to the vice squad, and they said, "Well, we'll get you an interview with a white prostitute." And they drove out in a nice residential area, knocked on this girl's door. She opened the door, and it was quite a shock that her first John of the day was John Law. You know, they said, "Hey, you're going to do an interview with Mike Miller, and whether you like it or not." And so she did. So she said that the best customers, her best customers, were used car dealers and Baptists. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what she said.
It's a good soundbite.
Oh yeah. But then the lawyers really got nervous. They ended up just letting me run one segment instead of five. And I leaked the whole problem to the radio TV columnist in the Dallas Morning News, which was owned by the same company, Velo. And he ran a piece on it the next day about how they had suppressed four episodes.
Did you run across that a lot, Mike? I did. Basically censorship because of business reasons, commercial reasons, or maybe legal fears.
Reasons.
Yeah, a couple of times. I remember one time I shot some film of somebody, I think it was Cleo Epps, the queen of the bootleggers.
Here in Oklahoma.
Who was appearing in the Tulsa Federal Building, and I was trying to get a shot of her. She got into the building before I could really get a good shot of her, so I ran into the building and got a shot of her inside the building, which was a no-no, and the judge held me in contempt, and our KOTV, I was working at Channel 6, Tulsa, and their lawyers had, and we all went with the judge in his chambers, and I think they prohibited that film from being run. But it's unusual. It doesn't happen too much. You know what would happen in the early days, though, a lot, is the sales department would get involved. And then, oh, you're not going to run this story. You know, they're a client.
Now, that's more of what I was faced with a lot.
Yeah, that's you run across that a lot, or I did. And or it would be just the opposite.
It's just, they want a plug. You plug them on the news, something pleasant, they may buy some advertising.
Do a story on Fred Jones Ford. We're trying to get them. You know. I remember one time, I think it was at KOTV, and the sales department was trying to land a bank. I can't remember which bank it was, but they wanted me to stand in front of the bank and interview people on the street, asking them to name their three favorite banks, and I was right in front of the bank they were trying to get advertising from. Not one of them ever mentioned the bank I was standing in front of.
Oh, really?
Not one.
I think they needed some advertising. I mean, if you're standing right in front of the bank and the subject is your favorite bank, you would think you'd run across somebody at least that had been in there.
That was the idea, that they could sell to this bank. Look, people standing right in front of your bank don't even know you're there.
Yeah.
And so we had to do that a few times. But, you know, things were a lot different in what I like to refer to as the golden age of TV. You know, it was before color, before tape recording, VCR, before...
Today's photojournalism's a piece of cake. Back then, you had all that heavy equipment. It was a logistical nightmare just getting the film back and getting it developed in time for the news.
Oh, yeah. I remember at Channel 2, my first job in TV, a lot of times the film, you'd be running it through the processor, and maybe it would come through, but then it had to go through what they call a dry box, where it would dry off the chemicals. And if the film would break or something would happen to the processor, you get the film out, but it was all soaking wet. And so you would run down the hall.
Yeah, I think they had those big fans in the hall sometime.
But a lot of times we'd run down the hall with this film trailing, you know, like half a block behind you. And I remember one time Harold Stewart, the owner of Channel 2 at the time, was showing some clients through, you know, and here I am running down the hall as fast as I can, trailing film behind me. I'm sure that made a great impression. But, yeah, you had to, also, the equipment was so huge.
Yeah, it was bulky.
Very bulky. You had these cameras that that weighed about 150 pounds, but were portable because they had a handle attached somewhere. And the audio was had to be processed along. It was on the side of the film. It was...
Yeah, the soundtrack.
Yeah, soundtrack. And if you had a processing problem, it also affected your
audio.
And
if you didn't cut it just right, that soundtrack would have a, you know, make a big noise.
Yeah, yeah. See, and you had to learn how to shoot. You had to learn how to process. You had to learn how to edit the film.
We're going to make some noise about politics and the media. Some interesting stories from Mike Miller. You're listening to Jerry Pippin Special.